And the microphysics and the early inroads, starting off with an introduction on the evidence for dark matter and then sort of going on to what we've done. But I thought that just since it's a cosmology seminar, I'm assuming most of you are fairly familiar with the evidence of dark matter, so I decided to do something a bit different. And so instead, the first half of my seminar, I'm going to sort of start with a bit of an introduction to standard picture and structure formation, which should still be fairly familiar stuff to most of you. Then talk about the work I've been doing over the past couple of years with Stefan and Dominic, and then finally start sort of thinking aloud about the sort of things that actually Stefan and I are trying to think about at the moment, to think about axions and their microphysics and how structure forms. And finally, if I've got time at the end, I'll say a few words about primordial black holes and dark matter. So just for the record, there's lots of evidence for non-baryonic cold dark matter from very diverse astronomical and cosmological observations, ranging from the rotation curves of individual galaxies through galaxy clusters to large scale structure formation through to cosmic microwave background. The one assumption, though, which underlies all of this is assuming that Newtonian gravity stroke general relativity is the correct description of classical gravity. So that's given if you've that assumption, then I think it's very hard to understand the properties of the universe without cold dark matter. And so then the question is, what is the cold dark matter? So to do that, one way where you maybe hope to learn something about dark matter is to look at structure formation. See, the nature of the dark matter affects how structure forms. And so I'll start by saying sort of a few words about the standard picture of structure formation, which I think is fairly well-known stuff, but I'll say it nonetheless. So the way we think structure forms is by gravitational instability. They're initially small fluctuations, grow as gravity is attractive, become bigger. And so the idea is you have sort of small fluctuations in the universe which grow, become larger and larger. And so the standard law is that in cold dark matter cosmology, structure forms hierarchically. Small things form first and then they merge to form bigger things. And that's a fairly well-known law, and here, for instance, is a simulation by Ben Moore and his collaborators in Zurich, formation of the galaxy cluster. And so you see lots of small things forming first and then basically bigger things forming later on as the small things come together and merge. And in this case, what you're ending up with is a galaxy cluster up here, but there's still lots and lots of smaller substructure flying around. So one thing which often isn't talked about is exactly why structure forms like this. I first thought I'd sort of start off by going through that. So in a very heuristic way, places of perturbations at any given time are a sort of product of the initial perturbations coming from inflation or wherever you think they come from, the gravitational growth, and then the microphysics of the dark matter can also affect the density perturbations. So to introduce some terminology, what people usually do is take the Fourier transform of the density field, and then work with most of the analysis is done in terms of these Fourier modes. And particularly people work with this power spectrum, which is related to the average mean of these modes. So let's have a look at the things that go into this calculation. So the first thing is the initial distribution. So the usual assumption here is the initial distribution of fluctuations is close to scale invariant. And there are two reasons for assuming this. First, there's not actually observational evidence from this. Now, if you look at CMB and large scale structure, in terms of the constraints on the spectral index, it ends a pretty close to one. It might not be exactly equal to one, but the point is it's not two, it's not zero. It's something close to one. So the fluctuations have roughly the same size on all scales. This is also actually to some extent a theoretical expectation if you think that inflation generated fluctuations. For instance, to have for inflation to occur, field has usually to roll slowly. And if the field is running slowly, then you have a very weak scale dependence on the fluctuations. Now let's have a look at the second bit, the gravitational growth. So how fluctuations grow depends on two things, whether the scale is smaller, bigger than the horizon, and also what the background evolution of the universe is. So I've tried to draw a little cartoon here. So this is the evolution of delta as a function of time, with matter radiation equality here, for radiation domination, and then matter domination. So this, and these dashes mark the particular scales I'm interested in enter the horizon. So the blue line is a very small scale that enters the horizon long before matter radiation equality. Now during radiation domination, inside the horizon, the fluctuations only grow logarithmically. So there is growth, but it's only very weak. After equality, during matter domination, the fluctuations can grow much more rapidly. So if you then consider another scale, grayscale, which is much bigger, but still nonetheless enters the horizon before equality, it also enters the horizon and then it grows logarithmically and then faster afterwards. And then finally, the red scale is something, a large scale, so think galaxies, galaxy clusters here, which enters the horizon after equality and immediately starts growing quite rapidly. So the offshoot of this is that these scales that are very different in size their amplitude ends up being nearly the same. Whereas this scale to enter the horizon after equality, there's a much stronger scale dependence of the amplitude of fluctuations. So that's probably going to be clearer from this plot down here, which is the plot of the logarithm with the fluctuations as a function of wave number here, and now at fixed time. So these scales here are still outside the horizon, so they're frozen in. And here I'm actually for experts working in the conformed Newtonian gauge, but it doesn't really matter. Then we come to these scales that enter the horizon after equality, and you can see that side fluctuation is a very strong function of the scale. Although once we then get down to these scales that enter the horizon here, this then growth falls over, and there's a very weak scale dependence, it's only logarithmic, and that's going to turn out to be very important later on. So, question might be, so these small scales, why are they interesting? Well, the first is sort of a general interest question. When did the first structures in the universe form and how big are they? I mean, that's the sort of thing it's good to tell your granny about, but you know, it's not really motivation enough to spend years working on this. There's also a technical issue, and this is the point that Stefan and Dominic are both fond of making, is that the standard structure formation calculations involve perturbation theory. And that really only works if all the modes are small. And so if you had structure going down to ever smaller scales, there would always be a mode which is too big for perturbation theory to work. So you'd need to impose a small-scale cutoff to get perturbation theory to work. Why I'm interested in this question is actually practical reasons, because if we've got all this evidence for dark matter, we'd really like to confirm that it actually really does exist. And so the way that people try to do this is looking for, well, one of the ways is looking for dark matter in the lab. So for instance, WIMPs, which I'll talk about in more detail later, the way people do this is they set up a detector in their lab and they look for the WIMPs coming in and elastic scattering off target nuclei in the detector. So if you're going to do that, you need to know how the WIMPs are distributed in the lab. So you need to know how they're distributed on very small scales of order the size of the detector. It's actually not quite that bad, because obviously the detectors are order, say, you know, a metre, but we're travelling around the centre of the galaxy at 220 kilometres a second. So really what you're doing is you're sweeping out the volume of order a fraction of a milliparsec a year. So you need to know how dark matter is distributed on milliparsec scales. WIMPs aren't the only game in town. Another concept I'll talk about more later is axions, and people try to search for them in the lab by if you get a magnetic field cavity, if you tune the frequency of the magnetic field, you can convert your axions into photons. And so yet again, you need to know how the axions are distributed in the lab if you want to do this. And then finally, a bigger question is, are there actually any observational consequences of the nature of the dark matter? Or to put it another way, how sensitive is structure formation to the nature of the dark matter? If you change the dark matter properties too much, can you change the successful picture of structure formation that we have? So I'll start by looking at how structure forms with WIMPs. So firstly, introduction to WIMPs. So WIMPs are neat because any weakly interacting massive particle which is in thermal equilibrium in the early universe has an interesting density today, by which I mean roughly in the right order of magnitude to be the dark matter. And this sort of very classical plot sort of shows what's going on. So in the very early universe, the temperature is very high. You get this reaction going both ways. The WIMPs can interact and annihilate forms of radiation particles. And this can go back the other way to produce WIMPs. And when that happens, the co-driving number density of the WIMPs remains roughly constant. Now, as the universe expands and cools, what will happen is that this reaction will start only going in this direction, as these particles won't have enough energy to create WIMPs. So what would happen is then you'd expect this catastrophic fall off in the density of the WIMPs, i.e. you'd be left with none today. But in fact, as the universe expands, the density of WIMPs decreases, and because they're weakly interacting, the reaction stops going in this direction as well. So the consequence of that is that the number density freezes out at a constant level, and what the number of WIMPs you're left with depends on the interaction cross-section, as in how quickly interacting they are. And you can do a sort of very simple back-of-the-envelope calculation. You get this relation for the present-day WIMP density. So here we've got the mass divided by the temperature at which this freeze-out occurs, which, if you do the calculation properly, is of order 25. And here's the velocity average annihilation cross-section, which is something which has interactions with the weak scale, is of order of picomoles. So very roughly, you end up with an interesting number. And of course, when people actually do calculations, they do them a lot better than that. So that's the generic motivation for WIMPs. There's actually more motivation, in particular for supersymmetry, the standard extension of the standard model of particle physics. And in supersymmetry models, each standard model particle has a supersymmetric partner. And I'm sure most of you are aware of this, there's a number of motivations for supersymmetry. For instance, understanding the gauge hierarchy problem, why the weak scale is much less than the Planck scale. With the unification of coupling constants, you can see how the coupling constants are fundamental forces. Get run with energy, they look like they're going to unify, but they don't quite. However, if you add supersymmetry in, you then do get a unification. And then finally, and this is not something I understand, but apparently supersymmetry is a necessary part of trying to build a successful string theory. So there are a bunch of good motivations for supersymmetry that have nothing to do with dark matter. Now, in most of these supersymmetry models, the lighter supersymmetric particle is stable. And that's a consequence of our parity, which is needed to prevent the usually proton decay with a life which is less than the age of the universe. And basically that means that supersymmetric particles can only be created and destroyed in pairs, but the lighter supersymmetric particle is safe, it's got nowhere it can decay to. And it's usually a mixture of supersymmetric partners, a photon, Z and a Higgs, so it's neutral and it's stable, and that's exactly what you want your CDM to be. So supersymmetry naturally provides us with a good CDM candidate. So people always assumed that what I've told you so far was kind of the end of the story. The wimp spreads out in the early universe, and then they suck around and they were dark matter. And that was that. But it turns out there's a lot more interesting physics in there in the early universe. And in particular, so the freeze-out means that they chemically decouple. They stop interacting chemically with other species. But they can still interact kinetically. And there's been a large number of papers on this, but really, these guys are the ones that really worked out the details of this correctly. So even once this reaction has frozen out, you can still get kinetic interactions with the WIMPs with other particles. And then finally, these will cease when the relaxation time is of order the Hubble time. That should be an approximate rather than an equals actually. There's a very important point in here which is missed in some of the early papers of this. And the important time here is the relaxation time and not the collision time. And the reason for this is that actually the momentum transfer in each one of these scatterings is very small. It's of order the temperature. Whereas the momentum is of order its mass, it's much larger. So that means you need a very large number of interactions to cause or establish to cause deviations from or to establish thermal equilibrium. So the important point is that this relaxation time, which determines when the wimps kinetically decouple, is far larger than the collision time scale, which is the time scale on which individual interactions occur. If you don't take that into account, you get the kinetic decoupling temperature very wrong. And so what we did a calculations, we were sort of trying to be as generic as possible, so we sort of parameterized the WIMP in a very simple way, and just said that the last scattering cross-section is sort of a weak scale with this temperature dependence, and consider two possibilities. N equals zero, we sort of had in mind a sort of standard modulus type particle which could interact by a Z-naught exchange, and then the N equals one case takes it sort of is the more standard sort of neutralino supersymmetric particles which interact by a fermion exchange. And so what we did is, using this interaction cross-section, we calculated the chemical decoupling temperatures and kinetic decoupling temperatures. And so this is what this plot is here. This axis is the chemical decoupling temperature, so that's the freeze-out temperature, and this is the kinetic decoupling temperature. So these...
Scattering of the tumors is the most important?
No. So what we did here is we pick out models which had the right density to match the W-map density, and this colour scale here is the mass going from very light to very heavy, so it's of light ones are down here, and the heavier ones are up here. So, and the bottom line is the L equals zero is a sort of standard modulesque case, the L equals one sort of symmetric type WIMPs are up here. So what you can see is that chemical decoupling temperatures can have a sort of wide range of values from a few GeV to tens of GeV. The kinetic decoupling temperature has a similar range of values from a few MeV to tens of MeV, so it's three orders of magnitude smaller. So why is that interesting? Well, it turns out there's interesting microphysics going on. And this is in this period in between chemical decoupling and kinetic decoupling, you get these interactions between radiation and wind fluids. And you get energy being transferred from the winds to the radiation fluid, and due to bulk and shear velocity, and that ends up raising density perturbations on small scales. Now, Stefan and Dominic originally calculated this in great detail using kinetic theory, but to give you a heuristic sort of explanation, you can use the kinetic theory to calculate these functions of viscosity for the shear of bulk and shear velocity in terms of the temperature, the number density, and the relaxation time scale. And then what you can do is you can see how you can write down a very similar Navier-Stokes-like equation telling you how the perturbations vary with conformal time. So you get this equation here, and what you see is this is going to be basically an oscillator, and you get a term, with a positive term, which the real term, which sort of encodes these sort of propagation fluctuations, and then an oscillating term, which is coming from here, which encodes the damping. And so it's that which then tells you that the fluctuations are being damped on very small scales. That's still not the end of the story. So even after kinetic decoupling, the winds stop interacting sort of with anything else. They then free stream. And so this is exactly the same thing as neutrinos. The difference being that neutrinos are relativistic, so they travel very fast and can cover large distances. The winds are traveling very slowly, so they travel cover very small distances. But nonetheless, they erase perturbations on very small scales. As in, it's fairly simple, and if you've got an overdensity of winds on small scales, they can stream out of it and smooth that overdensity away. And so what we did is we actually sort of calculated this in great detail by solving the collision as Boltzmann equation, taking into account the initial perturbations from this epoch. The bottom line is this, that there's a net damping factor. So this polynomial term in here is from taking into account the initial conditions at kinetic decoupling properly, and then you get two exponential damping factors. And in both of these cases, the characteristic scales of the damping depend on the wind property. So I haven't written down the equations. What I've done instead is showed you our plots for our sort of generic winds again. So here we've got the collisional damping, co-moving wave number in inverse parsecs, and the same thing for the free streaming damping number. And you've got the end of the zero case just tucked up here, where you get the bigger range in these scales for the n equals 1 supersymmetric line case. So I think that plot on its own probably doesn't show you too much, and I'm going to show you some plots which do, but for that, a couple of comments. So what we were trying to do was trying to treat the problem analytically to get intuition for how things work and come up with analytical equations, but it was very easy to investigate, for instance, dependence on the mass. After we did that, there were some few refinements of the calculation published, and in particular, Lopez Aldariaga carried out a numerical calculation, but they could include all of the terms, and what they found is the Boltzmann calculation captured most of the physics. There were some additional features, in particular that the wind fluid had a memory of the coupling to the radiation fluid. And then it turns out the CDM fluid on small scales has oscillations, which result from the oscillations of the radiation fluid. More recently, this summer, Birchinger went even further, and what he did was to numerically solve the full Boltzmann equation. So it ends up with a Fokker-Planck-like equation with sort of describing how the velocity of the wind changed with various terms of elastic scattering, advection, and gravitational forces. The net result of all this, and I'll show you some plots in a moment, is that our calculation correctly gives the envelope of the damping factor, but that there are oscillations underneath this envelope. So the bottom line is, if you want something which is good to a factor of a few, our calculation does the job, but if you want something which is good to tens of percent level, then you need a numerical calculation. So to show you some actual practical things which you might be interested in, for instance, what does the power spectrum for the density perturbations look like at the end of the day? So, well, at the end of the day, actually, I think this is a redshift of 500. So this is way after the early universe, but before structure formation starts. So this is, well, power spectrum is a function of wave number in terms of co-moving wave number and the horizon equality. Now, what you'd have if you didn't have a cutoff would be this dotted line, i.e. fluctuations would carry on getting bigger and bigger and bigger, smaller and smaller scales. But what happens with the microphysics is that you get a very sharp cutoff, and in particular, it's the free streaming which has the dominant effect. And you get this very close, sharp cutoff kicking in at a scale of order 1 inverse parsec. So the results of Birchinger's refined calculation, unfortunately it's not possible to do a direct comparison as sort of the notation he worked with and the quantities he worked with were a bit different. But this is essentially, so our calculation would have the envelope here, whereas he picks up these oscillations. So given the power spectrum, you might like to go on and say something about how structure actually forms. And a very sort of simple thing you can estimate analytically with sort of linear physics is the redshift at which typical, that is one sigma fluctuations on a given physical scale, actually go non-linear, as in when the fluctuations become of order one, and then non-linear structure formation starts. So this is defined in terms of this quantity called mass variance. So the z non-linear is the redshift at which this, for a given scale r, is equal to one. And so everything we've done up until now has been in terms of Fourier space, K space. So obviously when structure forms, that's something that happens in physical space. And it's the mass variance which gets you back between the two things. So you take your power spectrum and you basically integrate it over a window function, which can be a Gaussian or a top hat. And basically what the window function does is it picks up the modes of the power spectrum which contribute to structure formation on a given physical scale R. So we did this calculation, and then this here is going to be a plot of redshift and nonlinearity, i.e. when things go nonlinear and stretch forms, as a function of real space scale R. So yet again, this dotted line here is what we find if you didn't have a cutoff. So you'd have smaller and smaller things forming at earlier and earlier times. But what the cutoff does, it means that, well, smaller and smaller things form earlier and earlier times, back to here, back to things, coding scales of order of parsec. These are the smallest things that form, and they do so at a redshift of something in the range of 40 to 60. The one thing to remember here, which is easy to forget, is this tells you about when typical one-sigma fluctuations collapse. In reality, there's going to be a distribution of functions, and so various fluctuations will form early. And in particular, if you say have an n-sigma fluctuation, it's going to collapse a factor of n sooner. So this tells you about when typical objects form, but of course rare objects will start forming a lot sooner. So that was for a sort of benchmark calculation. You can vary various things. So, for instance, you can vary the properties of the wind. And so that's what these plots, the same sort of thing as I showed you before, but varying the properties of the wind. So keeping everything else fixed. And so we're looking at sort of standard model S-like wind with mass order 100 GeV, or a sort of symmetric light wind with mass 50, 100, or 500 GeV. So what you find is the cutoff scale can vary significantly. So we've got variation here by about an order of magnitude. And then that feeds through, the cutoff scale kicks in at a different point here, so the structures form at different redshifts depending on where the cutoff is. And also the mass, of course, will depend on where the cutoff scale is.
Your first example is already excluded, was it recently? If you have a direct particle, then
we were just trying to get a half, we weren't saying this is a problem, which is consistent with all known data. It's sort of getting a handle for how these things, and I'll show you some sort of improved results in a moment. So, in fact, here. So, afterwards, these guys, they sort of extended their work by actually sort of going into the scan of the mineral supersymmetric standard model, and also considered universal electric dimension models and other, and heavy neutrino-like dark matter. They just saw what effect that has. So here, these plots are the mass in GeV going from 0 to sort of 2 TeV, and first the kinetic decoupling temperature. So, I mean, basically the red points here are MSSM, the blue ones are MSUGRA, and so you're getting a sort of variation of actually here about two orders of magnitude, whereas in our simple calculation it's probably more like one order of magnitude. And then, of course, the thing you then want to do is see how that propagates through in terms of how this affects the cutoff scale. So here, on this axis, they've got the cutoff scale, or equivalently, the mass of the smallest objects. And they did this in terms of the Earth mass, which is like 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. And so what they found is this really range of maybe sort of three orders of magnitude in the cutoff scale, which translates to 9 orders of magnitude in the mass of the objects. So there's really quite a substantial variation there. Another thing you can vary is the primordial power spectrum. I've already mentioned at the beginning that there's some observational evidence that on cosmological scales, the power spectrum is fairly close to scale invariant. But so the range of scales are actually probed by observations is actually fairly small. And so they're a fairly small range of big scales, and we're interested in very small scales. So it turns out that actually very small scale dependence in cosmological scales can track into a big variation on the scales we're interested in. So we decided to drop the assumption of a scale invariant power spectrum and see what this did. And so this, we did it actually in the context of the first year WMAP results. We were looking at models which were at extremes of what was allowed by the first year WMAP. This was changed slightly for the 3 year data, but not significantly enough to make me redo this. So we looked at a bunch of benchmark inflation models. We looked at false vacuum dominated hybrid inflation model. And so that was chosen to have n as large as possible. So in this case, we've got positive spectrum index greater than 1, so the fluctuations are bigger on small scales than they are on large scales.
Is the alpha by d log k?
You're absolutely right. That's one hell of a typo. Yeah. So this should be the standard running, which should be d log k. Yeah. We also kept the scale invariant sort of standard case spectrum index exactly equal to 1, no running. We looked at a parallel inflation model where we had the smallest spectral index that was then consistent with the data and 0 running. and then to see what effect running, a small amount of running could have. We then looked at M squared phi squared chaotic inflation model with the same spectral index and the maximum allowed amount of running. So here, firstly, we've got the power spectrum. And so this is like from top to bottom. So if M squared to the 1 fluctuations are bigger on small scales, here we've still got our standard scale invariant case. And you see the running actually has a very small effect. The difference between these two models is fairly small. But this is a log scale, so the difference between these two models and that one is getting on for an order of magnitude. So this, in this case, we fix the wimp property, so the cutoff hits in at a fixed wave number. So these things, the sort of flattening off occurs at this fixed place, but because the fluctuations in this case are far bigger, that means they go non-linear far earlier. So you're getting a variation of sort of number about that redshift non-linearity changing by about 10 from just a very small dependence on scale dependence of the initial power spectrum.
Is this the first circuit we made with hybrid inflation? So for which potential is this n equals 1 for
So it's a constant plus I think it was n squared phi squared on top of the constant, but the constant dominating over the n squared phi squared.
But then it's specific to n squared phi squared, but you could have had something else.
I mean, we were just picking some random models out of the air to get a handle on the range of the uncertainties.
Yeah, because hybrid inflation, you can have n squared phi squared.
Yeah.
Or you can have, for instance, constant plus a log.
Yeah.
It can change completely.
Yes. Yeah. What this actually is perhaps unimportant. What is important is it's about as far high as you can push the spectral index at that time is why we chose that.
Because for log, it's actually, I think, it's less than 1.
Yeah, I mean, you only get this n greater than 1 with the case where you've got the vacuum, course vacuum dominating and a phi squared. So that's what you can do sort of with linear physics. What actually happens when structure forms? Well, we did sort of almost the back of the envelope calculation using sort of top hat spherical collapse. And so, well, we've already seen that these things form at redshift about 50 plus or minus 10. The mass is about 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, and the radius after collapse comes down to about 0.02 parsecs. So that's what we managed to do analytically, and that's as far as you can go analytically. What then happened is Niemann, Morris, Liddell, they took our analytic calculations of power spectrum and used them as inputs to numerical simulations. So this is a tricky thing to do because the resolution of simulations is limited. If you want to, say, simulate a halo as big as the Milky Way, 10 to the 12 solar masses, the particles in the simulation are about 10 to the 5 solar masses. So that's many, many orders of magnitude bigger than this. So what they used was something called the re-simulation technique, which is fairly standard in simulations, I believe. So they basically did a large-scale simulation, starting at a redshift of about 350. And so they picked out a particular region they're interested in, tracked back where these particles that end up here start from, and replaced the particles with lighter particles, and then ran the simulation again. And they found this. So then they sort of isolated the region in here that they're interested in and did the same trick again. And then we ran the simulation again, comparing this. So each of these zooms, which I think I've written down here, so I think something like, no, I can't remember actually. So what you see here is that in these two bigger pictures, you see substructure on all scales. When you get down here, there's no substructure in here. This is really the first objects that are forming. So this is really neat, but unfortunately, as soon as the region you're interested in starts merging with its surroundings, you then get the sort of lighter particles you've done your simulation with getting mixed up with the heavier ones, and you're going to get all sorts of nasty numerical effects, so you've got to stop the simulation there. And so in the case when they were doing this, they had to stop the simulation at a redshift of 26. So what did they see? Well, firstly, basically the properties of their simulated halos agreed with our quick analytic calculation in terms of the mass, which is kind of good, they've been worrying if they hadn't, but also because they've done a simulation, they could get some more information out. And in particular, they could look at the density profiles of the halo as in how they varied with radius. This is density as a function of radius. And so they looked at three sample halos. In the text, they say that their density is well approximated by a power law with index 1.52. But what they actually do in the figure, it seems, is plot something called an alpha beta gamma profile, which is a generalization of the Navarro and Frank White profile, for those of you who know, which is a good fit, at least in the outer regions of larger halos. So you see something and you get sort of steep sort of outer profiles, which then slowly turn over the further you go in. But really, I don't think the resolution of these simulations is good enough to say anything too much about exactly what these density profiles are. I also think if you look at the mass function. So here, you've got the mass function, this function of mass, and here again, the circles are for a simulation with no cutoff. And so what you'd see is this mass function, logarithmic mass function, going as n to the minus 1 to get more and more things down to smaller and smaller scales. But with the cutoff, they find this turnover at 10 to the minus 6 solar masses. Now, of course, this is the what's going on at a redshift of 26, which isn't particularly interesting directly for anything you might want to measure. So the big question is, what happens to these mini-halos after zenith is 26? Well, they undergo the same sort of disruptive processes and dynamical processes that larger halos undergo. Once they're within the larger halo and sort of orbiting within it, if the gravitational field of the parent halo is bigger than their gravitational field, the matter gets tidally stripped off and removed to outer regions. They also undergo lots of mergers. In particular, this is important for small halos because the density perturbations are very weak scale dependence. That means that objects of similar sizes form at the same time, and so there'll be a lot more mergers. And so these things you would naively expect, at least, a lot more of them are going to get destroyed very early on. But those are sort of processes which, in theory at least, even happen with bigger objects. The one thing which the small halos are subject to, which the bigger halos aren't, is that they can be destroyed by interactions with stars. And so very shortly after the Demons et al. Nature paper appeared, there was a paper by Hongqing Zhao and his collaborators, including James, pointing out that these things could well get destroyed in interactions with stars. And so this then led to a bit of a pantomime response from Moore, where they said, oh, no, they won't. And there's been a bit of sort of going back and forth about this over the last year. I think, so my understanding of this is that this is certainly an issue. So basically, because these things are really quite light and fluffy, if a star comes near to them, there's a good chance that it will remove a lot of its mass. The difficulty is, though, that simple calculations that people, including myself, have done are in terms of the energy input into these halos and not the mass loss. So the big sort of uncertainty in the problem is how the energy you pump in translates into mass removal. And then also you need to know how these things are orbiting within the Milky Way. Obviously, something that's in the very outer regions, if it never goes through the galactic disk, it's never going to count as stars, it'll be fine. But if you've got something which is on some box orbit which goes through the disk lots, it's almost certainly going to lose a lot of its mass. So it's a very sort of stochastic problem, and I think it would be fair to say that working out the spatial mass distribution of these mini halos in the solar neighbourhood in particular, which is sat in the disk of the Milky Way today, is a really non-trivial problem. So that is actually an open question, but there's still some interesting consequences. So even if they lose most of their mass, because these density profiles get steeper and steeper down to small radii, they could still keep a small dense core. And so the nearest of these things could really be near enough to us that, for instance, the glass, and this is something which Kushiyapas has recently written a paper on, they could be near enough to us that the glass satellite could see them as moving point sources. So that's kind of an interesting thing. Unfortunately, his calculation, what he did was treat the disruption as an all or nothing thing. They were either destroyed completely or survived completely, whereas in reality, I think it's going to be come down to how much mass they can hang on to. More concretely, though, even if they're all actually sort of destroyed completely, the question is what happens to the material that's removed? And what happens to it is it's torn off in streams. The big question is what happens to those streams? Sat here, sort of in the lab with our detector, are we going to get individual streams coming through the detector? Are there going to be lots of overlapping streams so it's as if there's a smooth distribution? And that, I think, is very much an open question and something that Mike Merrifield and I in Nottingham are trying to sort of work out at the moment. So, health warning time. Everything I've said up until now, apart from perhaps the last little bit about mini-halo survival, is reasonably well established. I think it's there. I don't think there are any sort of big surprises coming, and it's well understood. Everything I'm about to say should be taken in the spirit of me thinking aloud. It's things that I think are problems and that Stefan and I and other people are trying to think about, but we might be on the wrong track. So you really shouldn't sort of take this as being sort of set in stone. So the obvious question is, well, we've looked at WIMPs. What about other dark matter candidates? What's their microphysics in the early universe, and how does it affect structure formation? Well, WIMPs are kind of the most popular dark matter candidate, but also equally well particle motivators arguably are axions, as in that they also have a motivation for particle physics, and they're not cooked up solely to be dark matter. And so axions, they're a consequence of the Petri-Quinn symmetry, which is proposed to solve the Sprong-CP problem. Now, we know that CP is not an exact symmetry of nature. For an instance, a weak interaction violates CP, and so you'd expect a strong interaction to 2, and where that would show up would be in a non-zero electric dipole moment of the neutron. But when experimentalists try to measure this, the upper limits on it are tiny. So one thing you can do is you can say, well, that's just a parameter of the theory, we'll set it to be very small. But that's not very satisfactory. By very small, I mean 10 to the minus 9. So what these guys did instead was introduce a symmetry, the idea being that you have a symmetry which explains for this parameter it's small. So the symmetry comes in terms of a field, and this field has an associated particle, the axion. And I'll say a lot more about this in a few minutes, but its physics is very different from the wimp. It's very light and very weakly interacting. And so it's never in thermal equilibrium in the early universe. There are constraints on the mass of the axion, or alternatively its coupling, FA, these two things are sort of an inverse relationship to each other, from cosmology, lab searches, and from some cooling of stars and supernovae. So the cosmology constraint is basically that you can't have omega axions being greater than the amount of matter we think there is in the universe. People have initially looked at accelerators, and then this kind of neat thing is that you can actually say something from astrophysics. I mean, these would be very light particles, and they carry energy away from supernovae, or will cause cooling in stars. And it turns out that we very well understand the physics of stars and supernovae. And so there are constraints on the mass of the axion for the fact that you don't screw up stellar physics, here from supernova 1987A, and here from red giants. So you're left with this range of parameter space for masses in the order of 10 to the minus 5 electron volts. So these things are much, much lighter than the wimps I was talking about earlier. So the early universe of microphysics. So because they interact weakly, they're never in thermal equilibrium, so they're not sort of generated in the same way that the wimps are. There are other non-thermal production mechanisms, and they're far messier, unfortunately. So the sort of kind of almost the simplest one is something called the misalignment angle. So the idea is basically the axion field to some extent is generated at this Petri-Quinn phase transition, which occurs in the early universe at a temperature of order of the coupling, which is something like 10 to the 12 GeV, give or take. At that point, the axion field doesn't have a potential. Although it then gets a mass much later at the gluon phase transition due to instanton effect. So you have this mass then switching on. So what happens is that the sort of fields are all over the place in the early universe. But when gluon phase transition sort of happens, it suddenly finds itself up here on a potential. And the potential has this form here, where the axion mass is temperature dependent. This is typically a power law. And you've got 1 minus cos theta. So around the base of the potential, you've got m squared phi squared. And so if you have coherent, what you have is the field oscillates coherently around the minimum, and it turns out that if you actually sort of work out the equation of state, this is equivalent to cold dark matter. And so the density of atoms you get depends on where it starts off. So basically, you can work out the energy density at this point, and that's the number of density of axions you get. And so this happens at some temperature T1, which is about a GeV, which is basically saying when these oscillations start, when the mass of the axion becomes roughly equal to the friction from the Hubble damping. So you get these axions formed, and one of the big important points is that you've got some material that's found from plasma, which is being transformed into axions, so that whatever density perturbation you get in axions has to be compensated by one of the opposite sign of radiation. So these are isocurvature perturbations. So it turns out the early universe physics is mucky, and it depends in particular about whether inflation occurs, and if it does occur, what the reheat temperature is. So the simplest case which people looked into first back in the 80s is if inflation doesn't occur, or inflation does occur, but the reheat temperature is high enough that symmetry is restored and then breaks again, so as far as the axion is concerned, inflation didn't happen. So the coherent plane for the axion field, that's the sort of scale over which it can be uniform, is of order the horizon scale at the Petri-Quinn phase transition when the field is created. And that's much, much smaller than the horizon scale of the QCD phase transition when it gains mass. The picture is that the field has a sort of very widely varying distribution by the time it gains mass. You've got patches of values constant, but they're sort of wildly different across the universe once the mass switches on. So there are large spatial variations in the axion field. So if there's large variations in the axion field, there's large variations in the density of axions you get formed by this misalignment mechanism. So if you want to work out the mean density of atoms, you have to average over all possible values for fields, and it goes between minus pi and pi, so it turns out the average of that squared is pi divided by square root 3, and the bottom line is that you get an axion density which only depends really on the axion mass, and it also depends to some extent on the Skellig QCD phase transition, because that's something in principle which is knowable. Whereas the axion mass is on a free parameter. And so what you see is for something of order 10 to the minus 5, you get this sort of interesting density. And the uncertainty in here may actually be one wiggle even, as in there's possibly a factor of 10 uncertainty here in the exact physics of how this happens. The calculations are far less accurate than for the case of WIMPs. Turns out, though, that actually the misalignment angle mechanism isn't the only mechanism which axions can be created. And in particular, because you've got these large variations in the field across the universe, what you get is you get a network of axion strings formed after the Petrov-Klimov phase transition. So in between that and the QCD phase transition, where the mass turns on these strings, they oscillate and they wiggle and they radiate axions. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to work out what the energy spectrum and number of these axions is. The problem is that these are global strings, and so it's very difficult to do simulations that resolve the cosmological volume and the core of these strings. So different people try and do different extrapolations of different regimes to work out what you get. And so there were basically three teams based around these people, and they had complete baffles back when they were doing this about what they found. The bottom line is that there's an uncertainty of at least an order of magnitude in the density of axions produced, but it's roughly the order what you get from the misalignment mechanism. So in this case, at least, sort of string production is interesting. Even that isn't the end of the story, because after the QCD phase transition, when the mass of the axions turns on, you then get a network of domain walls joining the cosmic strings formed, and these domain walls then decay, producing yet more axions. And no one has really done a proper calculation of the number of axions produced by that mechanism. So that's all horribly messy. The other case is if inflation occurs and the reheat temperature is lower than the Petrov-Klimov scale. So what happens is then the entire observable universe originates from a region which is very small at the time of the Petrov-Klimov phase transition, so that the axion field initially at least has some constant value over the now observable universe. So what you'd naively expect then is that, well, the fields are uniform all over the universe, density of axions produced is uniform all over the universe, and depends on the particular value that the field has. And so if you do the calculation in that case, you get something very similar to last time, with the difference being that you get this unknown initial value of the field, and this is a correction factor if you're not close to the minimum. So here, in this case, it's not only the mass, which is something which is a number we don't know, you also get this dependence on the initial value of the field in the particular region of the universe in which we're sat. Although I don't think that's probably quite the entire story, because the axion during inflation is a massless quantum field, and therefore it's going to get quantum fluctuations during inflation. So there's also the question of, are those fluctuations big enough that then the field distribution isn't uniform? In this case, though, it's only the misalignment mechanism that's interesting, because the network of strings is a very inflated way by inflation. So how then does structure formation form? So firstly, going back to the case where either inflation doesn't happen or the reheat temperatures are high, but effectively didn't happen as far as the axion is concerned. So as I said before, you get these large spatial fluctuations. So this is very different to the case of WIMPs, where you have these small fluctuations originating from inflation that take a long time to grow. The axion fluctuations can be very large on small scales from the moment that the axion is created. And this is something which was first pointed out by Hogan and Rees back in the 80s. And so what this means is that as soon as sort of the matter density gets large around the time of matter radiation equality, you get axionic structures forming. And so then, for instance, Tolman and Katchev carried out more sophisticated numerical simulations of this, and they found that actually, because of various nonlinear effects involving the axion potential, this was an even bigger effect than you might have naively thought. More recently, over the summer, these guys, including Craig Hogan, who's one of the initial people to think of this, and Tom Quinn, who's a numerical simulations guy, came back and sort of looked into this issue again. So here they have the initial distribution of the axion field, which, because it's random, is essentially white noise. They evolve that through the QCD phase transition, and then use this initial conditions for a sort of fairly standard numerical simulation. And so this is the output of their simulation at a redshift of about 3,000. So they're already seeing structure forming. And there's sort of little things and bigger things. And, well, the property of the first axiomatic halos is something which could have been sort of estimated even back by these guys. It's basically the mass of the number of axioms you'd have within the horizon of the QCD phase transition, which is about 10 to the minus 12 solar masses. So substantially smaller than the WIMP case. They're also more dense. The radius is far smaller. So these things, and I'll say a bit more about this in a moment, are far denser. What these guys haven't done, despite the fact that it seems to me that they've got the material to do this, is they haven't worked out what the mass function of these things is. And it's really not immediately obvious to me that you can have things this big forming that early on without somehow violating what we know works about structure formation. Also, so this is from the misalignment angle production. One of the Cole and Kashek papers, they instead uses input the distribution of axioms from one of the axiom string calculations. And they claim that you can even get the same thing forming if the dominant mechanism which produces axioms is radiation by strings. So possible observational but experimental consequences. Well, this was pointed out by Colvin Tkachev, but these things are, because they're so dense, they can actually cause lensing of cosmological point sources. And for instance, the obvious example of cosmological point source is a gamma ray burst. The image splitting is tiny. It's of order pico or femto arc seconds. So it's not something which is ever going to be resolvable. What it shows up as is either fringes in the energy spectrum of gamma ray bursts, or if you can observe the same gamma ray burst by two detectors in orbit around the Earth at different sides of their orbit, one of them will be within the Einstein ring of the sort of axion cluster, and one won't. So one will have lensing, the other won't. The lens one will have a far higher amplitude than the other one. So there'd be some discrepancy as to what you think the intensity of the gamma ray burst is. And so various people, observers have actually done this, people there are lots of gamma ray bursts that have been observed now, do you see either of these effects? The answer is no. And so that what this ends up doing is putting a limit on the density of small axion clusters, or indeed any small dense objects. And the limit isn't actually horribly constraining, it's something like less than 0.1 of the critical density. So then going back to the other case, and this is one which we were trying to work out yesterday and not really getting very far. So this is when inflation happens after the axion is created. So the axion's massless scalar field during inflation is going to get scalar variance spectrum of fluctuations. Now, CMB in large scale structure is well known, really constrain the amplitude of isocurvature perturbations. There's really not much room in the observations for isocurvature perturbations. However, what you can do is the amplitude of these things is actually proportional to the Hubble scale during inflation. So the field gets kicked around Hubble H over 2 pi fluctuations. So you could simply make these isocurvature perturbations small by making the energy scale of inflation small enough. But does that mean that it means that CDM can't be axioms in this case? And there was a paper by these guys, and well, we're trying to understand exactly what they say, but it seems to be that the claim is that axioms can't be the dominant component of CDM, but exactly what dominant means, well, we're going to email them and ask. So finally, if I can just 5 more minutes, I'll say something about primordial black holes. So the two dark matter candidates I've talked about so far are very much the big two, as in they've got particle physics motivation for reasons other than just being dark matter. Primordial black holes are really a bit of a sort of interest of mine for it as a probe of the early universe, but nonetheless I've been thinking lately about how structure would form if the dark matter was in the form of primordial black holes. So they can form from various mechanisms in the early universe. Basically, all you need to do is have some way of getting lots of mass in one place. For instance, you can have oscillating cosmic string loops that then collapse, or you can have bubble wall collisions at phase transitions, but perhaps the most natural way, and this really requires no sort of extension of known physics, this is just GR, is from the collapse of large density perturbations. If density perturbations are sufficiently large, of order 1, at the time they enter the horizon, then gravity wins out over pressure, and you get collapsed to form a black hole just immediately. And so the mass of what you're left with is of order the horizon mass at that time. And so there's been various calculations about how big do the perturbations need to be for black holes to form. The original calculation for Bernard Carr back in the 70s said something of order a third. More recent numerical simulations have kind of come up with a number of 0.5, which is slightly higher, but it's pretty good agreement. And there's also been simulations by Shabatin and Sasaki where they think about things in terms of the metric perturbation, which is perhaps a more rigorous way of doing things, and say that has to be of order 1. So the picture is that you've got some distribution, probably sort of in the middle of these fairly close to Gaussian size of fluctuations, with its width given by this mass variance that I showed earlier. So the idea is that it would be the very large fluctuations out in the tail of the distribution that would form primordial black holes. And how many primordial black holes uniform obviously depends on the width distribution. If it's very, very narrow, it would be zero. If it's bigger, more significant. And so basically, the initial density of primordial black holes, you just get from sort of integrating over the tail of the distribution, you get this complementary error function, where its argument is the critical value divided by the width of the distribution. So primordial black holes are matter, so their density decreases as 8 to the minus 3, radiation density is 8 to the minus 4. So during radiation domination, the fraction of the energy density in primordial black holes grows. So what you can do is you can evolve from what you had to start with through to the present day. And if you do that, you get this factor here with the temperature at the initial time they form divided by the temperature of matter radiation equality. That's not particularly informative. What you might like to do is write this in terms of the mass of the black hole. So in particular, things with black holes which are very large, less than 5 times 10 to the 14 grams, they evaporate by a Hawking radiation, so they'll be gone. They can't be dark matter. So if you want the black holes to be dark matter, they have to be more massive than that. And it turns out the mass scale is temperature to minus 2, so you end up with this factor in front. So if you want to say, well, if I want the dark matter to be in the form of black holes, what does the mass variance have to be? And the answer is about 0.05. Now, on cosmological scales, if you sort of put in your scale and then paraspectrum and normalise the W map, what you actually get on these large scales is 10 to the minus 5. So what that means is if the paraspectrum is completely scale invariant, the number of primordial black holes you produce would be absolutely negligible. However, you can increase the value on small scales to be this big by adding a sort of feature in the paraspectrum or by having running of paraspectrum. It turns out you don't have to do something too extreme. In terms of the spectral index, you'd have to change it to something like 1.25. Now that's ruled out by WMAP, but you can do it by changing the running by an amount which is allowed by WMAP. The problem is, and this is why I don't like primordial black holes as a dark matter candidate, is that this thing is very sensitive to what goes in the argument. So you've really got to tune this to probably 3 or 4 decimal places to make the right amount of primordial black holes. You either fill the universe full of them, or the number's completely negligible. But sort of nonetheless, what would the consequences be for structure formation? So the point is that because the fraction of the density in the form of black holes grows with time, to have the right number, single order 1 today, the initial number has to be something like 10 to the minus 20. So they're very, very rare initially. So they're forming from the very rare high peaks in the density field, 10 sigma peaks. And so something which sort of this very famous paper did was studied the high peaks in the density field, and they're clustered. The rarer they are, the more clustered they are. And so people, when they said that all dark matter can be primordial black holes, they haven't really sort of worried about this too much, apart from perhaps a couple of recent papers. They've just said, well, it's dark matter. But of course, if your initial distribution of these objects is very clustered, that's obviously going to have some effects. Does structure then still form in the way you need it to, or do you get clusters of primordial black holes formed? And in particular, yet again, these things are going to be isotope fluctuations, as in they're forming from the radiation, you're then stealing some radiation for it to be a black hole. I don't think there are constraints from CMB here, because the point is these fluctuations are on tiny scales. So I don't think there are constraints from CMB, but the question is, does structure formation still work on larger scales? So, at that point, I'll come back to reality and give you some conclusions. So, starting point is that I think there is lots of good evidence for dark matter from diverse observations. If you believe that general relativity is correct, then you have to take dark matter seriously. There is a bunch of well-motivated dark matter candidates, so what we'd really like to do now is actually detect the dark matter and prove that it exists. So what I'm interested in is, can you actually tell anything about the nature of the dark matter from some observations, and also you need to understand dark matter distribution if you want to then be able to detect it in the lab. And so then what you need to do is you need to look at how these things behave in the universe, their microphysics, and then map that through into how structure forms. So this is something that, you know, there's a lot of work been done over the last years, and I think the microphysics is very well established how these things behave in the early universe. But there are still some tricky open issues as to actually the structure formation, in particular the dark matter distribution on small subgalactic scales today. And then, really, it's only WIMPs that people have seriously done these calculations for. Axions, I mean, what we've uncovered is that the microphysics and cosmology are far more complex, and there's a lot of work that still needs to be done. For the point of primordial black holes, microphysics there is straightforward. This is just general relativity, but I'd argue they aren't a great dark matter candidate anyway. But it would be interesting at least to have a look at their clustering and see whether you could rule them out even if the structure wouldn't form as you need it to. And so basically, I'm here for next week, so this thing's Stefan, and we're hoping to make some progress on these issues, so I'd be very interested to hear from anybody who's got any ideas or wants to shout at me for talking nonsense in the second half of this talk.
Is it possible that dumping of CDM has only caused a problem?
I don't think so, because the scales involved are we're talking sort of hundreds of parsecs, whereas this. I guess what you're perhaps asking is, could warmed up matter counting do that? Is that what you're asking? I guess if dark matter is warm, then it's reaching over much bigger distances, and that's something that people have looked into.
Can I ask a question, a comment? What's the cluster problem?
So it's that the simulation halos have these profiles that go up as R to the minus. Well, you know what this is.
What's the problem? Baryons are still by far most important things in this sort of galaxy. So what's the problem?
But perhaps the argument is that observations show that there is no need for these things, and even in many cases, you can have a cusp of dark matter distribution. It's very hard to understand how the baryons could take a cusp like that and turn it into a core.
But still, if you had a Navarro-Franklin-White, cusp, and then a central 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole, and then the baryon profile like the one that we observed on Milky Way, there's no point at which the dark matter becomes a problem. Because in the inner regions of black holes, and further out the rods and minus 1.8.
I thought black holes were really only in the inner.
Yeah, but they're very massive.
It's only if you were in the low surface brightness galaxies,
right.
And so there's a particular range of objects where that look like they form cosmologically, sort of hard to understand because the observation is from cosmology.
So can I ask you a question then?
Yeah.
So a few years back, James Biggin was claiming there was a problem in the Milky Way. So the point of optical depth has gone down far enough that there isn't now, or are you just worried about it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if that problem's gone away. In the Milky Way, you do know the inner bit is, or should be, very undominated anyway, so.
I think the argument was that there was no room for dark matter of any sort, so we could don't know.
I mean, I don't know, maybe the arguments, there's more, it's easier to imagine feedback or some baryon process operating on Milky Way scales because it's baryon dominated. So
right,
baryon
right,
set a minimum dominant potential, whereas with low surface brightness galaxies, if you wanted to invoke that, you would then, at the end of all that, have to get rid of all the baryons that did the work of moving the dark matter, because they're not there now. So there you have the puzzle of dark matter dominated structures with the core, whereas in Milky Way, I guess you have the puzzle of a baryon dominated core, maybe it's a bar or something.
So the next question has to be a comment about axions. What's that?
Interesting remark. There's no evidence to talk about in the Milky Way galaxy. And why do we expect to see it in the lab here?
I guess because there's no easy way to. I think there's no easy way to exclude some component of it. I mean, when you say there's no evidence for it, that means there's no evidence to within a factor of 2 or 3. In other words, it doesn't dominate over the baryons by a factor of 2 or 3. Anything less than that, it gets very hard to tell because you have to know exactly what the mass to light ratio of all the baryonic, all the stellar populations are, and those things aren't known to within, you know, at least a factor of 2, says so. So, yes, I agree that if there were no dark matter anywhere, then there's no reason to expect it here. But if there's dark matter in the rest of the universe, then there's no way to keep it out.
We don't observe the rest of the universe in labs.
Well, I mean, the outer regions of the Milky Way, at least, there is evidence for dark matter, so you'd have
it. Presumably, for some people, you eventually have to see a dark matter particle in the lab. Right?
Maybe.
To really be convinced that dark
matter. Well, there's indirect detection as well, which I haven't
read. I'm wondering if varying from astronomical observations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't, I don't think the word vehicle shows up in CMB. I mean, it still means, okay, at the time of CMB, you have some component you don't understand. Maybe it's not dark matter, maybe it's something else, because you still have to explain it. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, we can't build a lab detector to detect it, so it doesn't exist. I mean, clearly, there are many things we can't ever hope to detect in the detector.
Yeah, but to be lower, you're left in doubt, schizophrenic detection. If you have an alternative, you can always have an alternative.
Well, what about a black hole, right? It's not likely we're going to detect a solar mass black hole with a lab.
Yeah.
But you could infer it as by ruling out any other plausible explanation.
Solar mass black holes don't work as a microlensing
constraint.
Solar mass black holes don't work as a microlensing constraint. People look at stars in the large Magellanic clouds, so you can limit the density.
I'm just talking about the existence
of
black holes themselves.
That astrophysics gets you a long way with some of these constraints,
yeah.
So I guess what I'm trying to say.
That being said, lab detection would be nice. I'm not arguing with that.
I was just going to ask, what. With the primordial black holes, is there any primordial argument about what the mass range should be? I wasn't clear on that.
No, I mean, it would basically, you need the fluctuations to be large on a given scale, and whatever given scale it is that, so if you simply just had a running, the fluctuation would be largest on the smallest scale, as in immediately after reheating in the early universe, so then the mass will be determined by the reheating temperature. But that's in principle not known, so...
So, for instance, if you wanted 10 to the 9, that would be ruled out by the Lyman Alpha Forest or something like that, because you wouldn't have that much primordial power on this.
Yeah, so it needs to be smaller than anything that Lyman Alpha Forest can get at.
So what is that upper bound?
Sorry?
What is that upper bound, roughly?
Oh, sorry, back on what precisely?
On the masses of the PBHs that you can form. I mean, they have to be bigger than 10 to 14 or they often radiate away. What about the other end? That's what you're asking, right? How heavy can the biggest ones be?
And in principle, there isn't a limit. The limit comes from the Lyman Alpha Forest that you'd be seeing.
Yeah, what is that limit?
It's about 10 to the 9.
It's 10 to the 9.
So, this is just curious. What changes in the primordial black holes picture if you believe there's a very deep burn phase, a spiral or whatever, you know, some kind of contracting phase, and you should be reducing primordial black holes before the expanding phase? Has anyone looked into this?
Not to my knowledge.
But wouldn't the light on the black holes constrain the solar panel? No, just
saying. But you just make them light.
It should be different, basically, the old conventional black holes. So this ties in
it would depend on what the power spectrum would be, wouldn't
well,
it?
Yeah, this is one thing. So the mechanism for producing fluctuations is very good. But the second thing, there is a growing node always in this contracting frame, which presumably would make bigger black holes in this space.
For a given.
I'm just surprised no one has tried to try these with this kind of model.
Yeah, I was going to ask that question. So how do you detect one of these very, very small, dense axion microions? Is that an fluorescent detector? Genus don't produce back if they do.
Oh gosh, so you're asking the technical to go exactly how they do this?
No, it's all right. I just wondered if you knew if there was some clever way of doing it.
I mean, I think it is clever, though I don't know some technical details. I mean, you're getting photons to produce a radio frequency cavity, so exactly how
they... Yeah, it'd be radio frequency.
Although, I mean, that's a general thing. That's got nothing to do with the moving clumps. That's just the black axions.
The gravity overcomes the pressure, then the perturbation comes in. Grows depending on the size of the critical genes mass. So, how do you get black holes to form? You should get growth as normal.
And you just have to make the perturbation really so big.
Really big.
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, typically, fluctuations are 10 to minus 5 at horizon entry. We're talking 0.1, so they're absolutely huge.
So, what's the. Well, I guess it's the same question. I don't expect this to happen. Such a to be calculated.
So I think the point is sort of you have a distribution of fluctuation sizes, so whilst your typical fluctuations are going to be much smaller, you could entail, and because their matter and their fraction of density increases, for them to be interesting today, this only has 10 to the minus 20 out here, so you really only need a tiny number of informed at earlier times for them to be interesting later on.
Seems unlikely.
I agree. I don't think they're a good
dogmatic
candidate.
So the last question,
Professor Collins. Shouldn't we expect this to form anyway in their absence?
Yeah, so actually, I mean, this is the thing I did to my PhD thesis. We put the limit on the spectral index of perturbations in less than 1.25, and back then, we loved UMAP and Boomerang, that's the best thing you could get on the perturbations. And I've got a PhD student at the moment coming back to this issue to see what you can say in general. So, yeah, I think vast micromodule black holes are interesting. They tell you stuff about the early universe rather than being dark matter.
Yes, thank you very much for your
Thank you.